This is Edge Cases. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Wolf French.
And what's our topic this week, Wolf?
Sequential consistency.
Okay. The real trouble with us not knowing each other's topics is I have no chance to do a snappy comment because I can't think. I'm sure there's something about,
there's a rich vein of comedy and sequential consistency. I don't see what's wrong with you. Yeah.
Well, I haven't thought of it yet. That's it. Alrighty. So I don't believe we have any follow-up to go over.
Actually, I do have some follow-up. So you have I'll do that. So Neil John Hargraves, I think I pronounced his name correctly. If not, consider this, a custom mispronunciation of your name. That's the Edge Cases advantage.
Yeah, there you go.
He wrote in to give us a link. I forget what episode we mentioned. I think it was just the previous episode, but it was I talked about Quinn the Eskimo's WWC presentations. It was for Dub 2010. The name of the it was a two-parter. The name of the sessions was Network Apps for iPhone OS. I guess it was even before iOS at that point, although that seems wrong, but anyway. And
2010, that was definitely iOS.
Yeah, so that's kind of weird. And he also gave us a couple of links that actually linked to it. So I'll put those in the show notes for this episode.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And also, Quinn wrote some related sample code that also included a link to. It was MVC networking. And this is really a treasure trove of information. And if you had some questions why maybe things like AF networking were structured the way they are in terms of like having own threads of their own run loops and how you should balance the type of stuff, this is a really good backgrounder. I disagree with some of Quinn's architectural stuff or his MVC networking sample, but it's still a really good backgrounder. So for the main topic, it hinges off some feedback. So Daniel A. Steffen wrote a correction in episode 63. The title was ARM is kind of like dark matter. I said something like ARM V8 added something like the load linked store conditional atomic instructions that the PowerPC has and other processors have. He actually pointed out the instructions they add were for a different case, and those instructions are, I have it written down here, LDRA and STRL, which we'll talk about a little bit later. And he also linked to Herb Sutter, who has been at Microsoft for a very long time, very smart guy. He linked to a presentation he made at some Microsoft event, or maybe it was a C++ event, and when the video was through Channel 9 or something like that, which is Microsoft's kind of developer propaganda machine, video machine, that it was called Atomic Weapons, a C++ Memory Model, and Modern Hardware. And so I'll include a link to that. And this same presentation was also pointed out by Michael Tsai. And it's one of those things where I put in the queue to get to, and it was a long time coming, so... all those times that, Andrew, you asked me if I've done my homework yet, I said, no. This was the thing I was setting aside the time to do. Because, like Quinn's talk, this also was a two-parter, and each one was also an hour and a half. So it was a good 3 hours of memory model goodness. So it was a deep talk, and it also didn't include everything. So it was pretty heavy. So I'd like to talk a little bit about, I listened to that, and I learned a bunch of stuff, and I also have kind of a deep history of this stuff from the late 90s, and so I did some research, and I kind of put together kind of a layman's, or at least the semi-interested programmer's view on all this sequential consistency and memory models stuff, so hopefully we can make it at least somewhat entertaining, and so you can actually understand how it's actually really important for software correctness. So assume a processor and memory. So a processor executes instructions, and a memory stores instructions and data. And so right there, you already have your first problem. So we have two things, but we already have a problem. So memory turns out to be really slow in comparison to processors. So a 2006 CPU may execute about 10 instructions per nanosecond, and a nanosecond is at 1 billionth of a second. So that's pretty good. But it turns out it takes many tens of nanoseconds to fetch a data item from main memory. So that's two orders of magnitude. And so this, as soon as you talk about nanoseconds and a billionth of a second, it's really hard to kind of wrap your head around what, because even tens of nanoseconds sounds really fast to me. So I mean, the entire order's magnitude helps a lot. So let's scale this up to human terms. So we're going to do a little role playing here to get this all in perspective. So Andrew, you're the processor. You calculate things.
Ooh.
And I will be main memory. So this is as close to Shakespeare as we get on cases. and so I'll remember things. I'll be main memory. And so,
okay.
So Andrew, you call me up and you're like, what should I calculate? And I'm like, hey, why don't you add up A and B and store the result in C? And you're like, cool. What's A's value? Now, Andrew, you're really fast. Everyone says that. And you probably could add up two small numbers in your head, probably under a second. I have faith in you. So, but, you know, I'm main memory, so I'm really slow. And I also work for minimum wage. So so it takes me about 100 seconds to recall anything. And so that's a little bit more than a minute and a half. So when you ask me, so what's A's value? I hem and haw. And after a minute and a half, I finally reply 8. And you're like, oh, okay, great. What's B's value? I'm like, oh boy, you know, that would be another minute and a half. So la-di-da, check your watch, check Twitter, blah, blah, blah. And finally, I come back with a reply, 5. So, Andrew, I think you just did the math in your head because you're so fast. You just did 8 and 5, bingo, bango. You say, okay. You say, store 13 into C. And I'm like, okay, sure thing. Just don't rush me. You know, I got rights, you know. And it actually takes me a little bit longer to store stuff. It might take me like 2 minutes. So, it depends, man. You know, don't stress. I'll get it done. I'll get it done. And so really what you're talking about is that here it's taking you a second to calculate this, Andrew. And that's basically a 5-minute round trip for a calculation, for a single calculation. And so, I mean, if this was a human assistant, we'd all fire them, right? But unfortunately, we can't fire my main memory.
We can't fire you?
Well, you could fire me. It won't help with the latency problems. But that's so main memory is slow, and that's as good as it gets. And so main memory is large, and it's fairly inexpensive, but it's slow. But fortunately, we have technology to make faster memory, but it's really more expensive. So we balance these economic trade-offs to have a little bit of the very fastest memory and rewire it into the processor itself. And we call these registers. So now if Andrew, if you want to increment A 20 times, you now can remember A. You don't have to ask me. And so you have that all local, and you can basically do it in your head really fast. So I think A was like 8 before or something like that. So incrementing 20 times is immediate. And you don't suffer that 5-minute round-trip penalty each time for each increment. And so that's some really serious speed-up we have. So paying dearly for a little bit of very fast memory sped things up a lot. And it was a good trade-off. But it turns out we can do this even more. We can also buy memory that's slower than registers, but faster than main memory. And we can use this type of memory to speed things up further. To continue the inappropriate anthropomorphization of this topic, we're going to need another person. So I was just trying to think of who else we should pick on. And I think Daniel Jellicutt would be a good role model for this.
I'm sure he wouldn't mind.
That's why I figured. It had to be a good-natured guy. And we're going to assign him the role of a cache between the processor, you, and me, the memory. Now, the thing about Jellicutt, he doesn't work for minimum wage.
No.
He's more expensive than I am. But the nice thing about him is that he responds a whole order of magnitude faster than I do. So yeah. You only have to wait like 10 seconds for him to respond.
Okay.
And you can see now why he's in demand, right? Because he's so fast.
Mm-hmm. He's on a lot more podcasts than we are.
There we go. He is. Man, between his bit splitting and the core intuition, and then he did that, the one debug with Guy English and like the round table. Yeah, he's all over the place. And the thing with Jellicutt, though, as a cache, he doesn't remember nearly as much as I do. And I blame him growing up in California. But but he copes well with his limited memory abilities. Yeah. So, Andrew, from now on, when you want some data, you don't call me anymore. You call Jellicutt the cache instead of Wolf the main memory. And so if Jellicutt knows the answer, he'll reply much faster than I do. But if he doesn't, what will happen is that Jellicutt could end up calling me, and then he'll have to wait along with you. And this doesn't sound too good, but the upside of Jellicutt as a middleman is that he'll remember my answer next time you ask it. So next time he won't have to call me, and you guys won't both have to wait so long. So We can speed things up by copying the data around to more expensive but faster memory. But there's other tricks you can play, Andrew. So as the processor, you can look at the instruction queue and you can reorder instructions for faster throughput. So the classic example is that if you look at how most programmers write code, it tends to be like load a bunch of data, then do your calculations, then spit the results out. And since we're dealing with memory here, this is actually one of the worst things you can do because this takes a long time. So, Andrew, you can actually look at the instruction queue. And as a processor, you can reorder the instructions. You can see that there's like maybe three loads, and then it does the math with the data. And then there's three more stores out at the end. You can actually maybe execute the first two loads, or maybe just the first load, and then try to do the real work that you need to do. And it start to interleave the loading and storing of data with the actual calculations themselves. Now, this only buys you so much, and this is actually one of the reasons why single structured multiple data things like VaultAVEC and SSE and really pay off, because you can do a lot more work with the data, and you want the processor to be able to do a lot of these types of calculations. But anyway, so the idea here is that you can interleave the very expensive operations with things that you're really fast at, Andrew. And you can do the same thing with the stores as well when you actually write out the results. You can reorder things. There's also a few techniques where it turns out that I'm slower actually remembering things than I am. I'm slower as my main memory than actually storing things than I am returning answers to things. So this is a take-home point, is that loads are always faster than stores. So stores are even more expensive than loads. So you want to kind of make sure that your loads are as fast as possible. And so you want to mitigate how slow loads are by a few things. Number one, you can buffer your stores. Instead of, imagine that, before we were adding A and B to C. And then instead of just writing out C to main memory, calling up Jalkut and telling him that the answer is C, and to C is 13, you might just hang on to that for a little while and see if later on, if C gets overridden. So that way, instead of having to call Jalkut twice, you just can call him once. And that way, you've just halved your effective expense at updating memory.
Like a tree falling in the forest.
Yeah. I guess actually that might be store combining. So a part of this is that I should have put this, one of these things, the disclaimers at the beginning of it, that I am not a hardware designer. This is all, I'm very much a software guy. And as deep as
you're main memory.
Yeah. I am main memory, only in our Shakespearean edge cases here. These are the conceptual ways I understand all the stuff, and I've written a lot of atomic code and stuff like that, but you should take all this with a grain of salt, and this is all hand-wavy.
Well, this is outside of our range of expertise, like most of our topics.
Which, like all of our topics. you're a fool to listen to us. So an interesting thing is that, I didn't initially think about this way, but really, storing is communication. So when I think about storing, is like I just think of like bits being flipped, and that's it's the end of the day. But really, it's like storing is thus the act of storing is actually communication. It's almost like the wave particle duality, right? It's two different ways to look at the same thing, and so this is how processors end up communicating amongst each other, is that through storing, and that comes in handy later. This is a useful thing to keep in mind later. And so there's some other tricks. So we have Jalkut in the mix. Right now, he's just acting as a faster memory store, and kind of a faster middleman. Turns out that we can do things like amortizing the cost of him talking to me. Instead of him asking for me the main memory for one chunk of data at a time, he can ask for an entire line of data, maybe 64 words of data. So instead of this is common even like in disk subsystems, all that when you go to grab something off address 100, maybe at the same time should also be grabbing address 104 and 108 and so forth, because that probably will be the next thing they want. And disks, like file systems, do the same thing, at least like the file system layers. Well, when you ask for the first byte of a file, it's going to give you the first 4K, because you're probably going to be reading the next 4K. And those caches have been gotten even larger since then. So what Jalkut ends up storing as a cache is that he ends up storing cache lines, which are these, it varies in size in different processor architectures, but 64 words is on the kind of maybe on the high end for a cache line, but you might have, you know, hundreds of these that he ends up balancing. And so then we get into this realm. So this is all that's been assuming a single processor. And now we get into a multi-core, because we want to throw some money at the problem to make things go faster. So that means we can clone you, Andrew, and we can clone Jalkut, the cache. And the nice thing about me is that I'm already cheap, so as main memory is that I don't get cloned. Main memory is a set. It's a centralized kind of bottleneck for this entire system. So you guys get doubled up, but main memory kind of stays where it is. And the thing with multi-core is that all these optimizations end up being really complicated. And they're not complicated piece by piece, but they all kind of build on each other, and it makes communication with other processors really difficult.
yeah.
Because think about it. Here you have an instruction stream, right? And Andrew, as a processor, you're reordering how the loads and the stores. So, and when other processors want to deal with you, they're seeing these loads and stores out of effective order of the instruction stream. Have you ever had the pleasure of trying to debug optimized code? Like run it, like instead of, you know, we all run the, you know, we tend to debug the debug builds, but then you can flip some optimizations, which is unclang. And yeah. Then have you ever tried to like run it in a debugger?
Yeah, I have.
And
step through it in the debugger.
Yeah, so weird things happen with it, right? Because like you've gone through the compiler's optimization phases at that point. And the compiler knows what's known as the geometry of the hardware. It knows what's expensive, it knows what's cheap, and it will rearrange your code. It's not the processor that reorders code, but it's also the compiler reorder code. And what ends up happening is that you'll hit the single step button and you'll like go up three instructions. Or you might see a variable that you hit single step where you update X, but both X and Y get updated because they end up sharing the same memory space. And so this type of weird stuff is exactly the type of stuff you end up seeing outside when you have a multi-core system, what the other processes will see in the instruction stream from the original processor. So it turns out that there's a couple of problems here. And there's a way of dealing with this at different levels, but the way that we handle at the Jalkut the cache level is there's a bunch of ways, but the one that I'll focus on because it's pretty easy to understand is there's a cache coherency protocol where all the Jalkuts get to talk to each other and kind of figure out what's right and what's wrong. And the idea is that each of these lines has a couple of bits, literally a couple of bits. And it's called the MESI, or maybe MESI, I don't know. I've never heard it pronounced out loud. But it's the idea of how you're tagging each cache line and what state it's in. So MESI stands for Modified, Exclusive, Shared, and Invalid. So the idea is that, you know, you boot up Jalkut, the cache, and all his entries are marked off as invalid. And when a line gets filled, it's marked as exclusive. That means that line is in exclusive use by one core. And so any rights to that line doesn't have to be negotiated or broadcast to any of the other processors. And when it's written to, it's marked as modified. That means it can't simply be evicted. It actually has to be written to main memory. So that's something that Jalkut will end up taking on. And make a little note that later on when he talks to me, he has to take that cache line that has been modified and write it to main memory. And the And the nice thing about this is that he can do this all again. He not only can amortize like single cache lines, but then potentially can even amortize multiple cache lines when he's talking to me. So that's, you can see it definitely cuts down on bus traffic there, where memory has to flow back and forth off the kind of the shared main bus. And it's marked shared if that line is known in use by the other caches. So that means that so reading is not a problem, but if you go to write, what happens is that with that tag is that the caches have to communicate amongst themselves. You just can't just write the value to the cache line. Now they got to talk and they got to work things out. It's very, very kind of marriage counseling type thing. Not really, but and so that covers all the states. And then you might ask yourself like how this actually goes on. And so typically these components are on a bus, and the bus is essentially kind of a room where they all can communicate. So it's like maybe the old style 10 base T hubs, Ethernet hubs, where it's like everyone could hear what everyone else is saying on the network. So there's a technique called bus snooping, where everyone's kind of listening in and is noticing what addresses are flying back and forth, and they know that they should invalidate it based on, oh, this other guy is writing some memory, so I better invalidate my caches. There's also a technique called bus snarfing, where you actually will snarf the data as it goes over the bus, because like, you know you'll need it.
And it's really called snarfing?
It's actually called snarfing, yes. Mm-hmm. And finally, directory based, which is actually, you know, processes are kind of, we still have, obviously, we have like PCI buses and stuff like that, but more and more, especially with the non-uniform memory architecture stuff, is that these cache kind of mechanisms are going directory based, where it's more processors kind of talking amongst themselves, like point to point type stuff, and using, there still are interconnects. A shared interconnect, but they try to minimize that in because any shared resource that everyone has to contend for is a bottleneck. And there's actually a kind of a bigger point there, is that independence means concurrency, which means faster. Anytime you have like dependence among multiple portions, would be a data or hardware, that means that it limits the amount of concurrency that's possible. And that means that things just get slower. So the idea of like these processors all having to kind of these cores be able to kind of get in sync with each other. Pretty much that they need ways to, because you can't really throw away these optimizations where you reorder instructions or loads and stores. And you can't really throw away all these caching levels, because otherwise your processor is just really, really, really slow and no one's going to buy it. So we need a way to deal with this type of stuff. And so we have these barrier instructions that allow you can tell the processor that things need to be put in a certain order. And so there's a famous algorithm called Decker's algorithm that's a good way to think about how these processors need to be able to communicate. And so it's a way to solve concurrency critical sections without any special hardware, really, and at least if you follow a sequential consistency, which we'll talk a little bit about later. So the algorithm is actually pretty simple. It's like, imagine two processors, each of which has a shared flag. So if processor one wants to enter a critical section, what it does is that it sets processor's two flag to true, and then it tests its own flag to see whether or not it should proceed. Likewise, processor two, if it wants to proceed, it sets processor's one flag, and then it checks its own flag if it should proceed. And if you check your own flag and it's set, then you should wait. Otherwise, you enter the critical section, and you know you're the only one actually in this critical section. So these special instructions offered by processors if you get the ordering wrong on the Decker's algorithm, if you, Andrew, you probably saw, you know, a couple of those loads go by, and you're like, oh, I could be a lot faster if I, you know, you set, you know, processors to flag here. I'll just, but it's expensive to set that, push it off to main memory. And so I'm going to delay it. I'm going to push it off. I'm going to do it later. And then you test the next one. And maybe it even pulls off, puts off pulling the load because it already has it in a register. You can see how because storing is communication, the act of actually storing to memory is used as a form of communication between processors, that this has to happen in order. The loads have to happen in a certain way. The store has to happen in a certain way. And it has to happen in exactly that order. So fortunately, processors have barrier instructions that you can instruct the processor saying, I know you're doing all these really great tricks for me, but I need you to, here's the instruction that says, all loads that before the instruction, they need to happen now. And basically it's a way of enforcing the order. And so you have these different architectures have different, you know, levels of sledgehammer here of how big you want to go. Like, I think the original PowerPC, like 601 class, had this like sync, and that was pretty heavyweight. They've gone, there's like LW sync and iSync and stuff like that nowadays. But the idea is that, so loading stores, ordering stores, ordering loads, those are the biggies. And, oh, one thing on the literature is that you'll see referring to I've been using the term barriers here. Another common term is fences. So they're the one the same. Those mean the same thing. And so with these instructions, this allows processors and cache systems to have the same amount, have all these fancy tricks where they're reordering stuff and giving you great speed increases. But if you have a special code that you need to execute in a special order in regards with other threads and other cores, then you can use these special instructions to enforce the order. And if you know what you're doing, then you can make sure that everything works correctly, even in the case of the processors actually rearranging instructions for you. So this brings me to memory models. And Brian Cotes said this best in an article, which I'll talk about later. And so I'll just quote him here. A memory model describes the relationship between variables in a program, that is, instance fields, static fields, and array elements, and the low-level details of storing to them and retrieving them from memory in a real computer system. Objects are ultimately stored in memory, but the compiler, runtime, processor, or cache may take some liberties with the timing or moving values to or from a variable's assigned memory location. For example, a compiler may choose to optimize a loop index variable by storing it in a register, or a cache may delay flushing a new value of a variable to main memory until a more opportune time. All these optimizations are to aid in higher performance and are generally transparent to the user, but on multiprocessor system, these complexities may sometimes show through. So this is an important point, is that we've been talking at a really, you know, granted we've, you know, brought a gel cut and made this all, you know, person and kind of pretty easy to approach, but this is a hardware level thing. Like, hardware deals with memory addresses and registers and stuff like that. But as programmers, we deal with variables and functions and higher level ideas. And there needs, and what's the memory model is a mapping between these higher level ideas and what actually gets compiled down to and what bits actually get moved back and forth and how, and probably most importantly, how as these bits get updated in a multiprocessor system, what guarantees are made. And so it turns out that we have to have a big debt to Java. I know, we don't want to cut Java any slack, but Java turned out to be pretty pivotal here. That the Java memory model was originally defined in 1995. And Java has,
that's 20 years ago now.
But it turns out that a significant revision happened in 2005, and I'll talk about that. So it's not like Java is all that, you know, all that unique. But the important thing is that it was popular, and it actually ran across various architectures. So the so it turns out that how Java programs, because you get Java as bytecode, and so most of the Java runtimes actually do just-in-time compilation or something like that, and so how these programs actually map onto the hardware that they happen to land on. And remember, Java is very much into the hardware independence side of things. So it can easily land on a Spark as easily as a Power or PowerPC or PA RISC if you want to get obscure.
Right. I mean, the whole thing about C-based languages is that they're variably defined in order to be faster on the hardware, whereas Java threw all that away for, no, it's going to be exactly this.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Exactly, yeah. So I actually didn't know this was a problem at all, but apparently that they had some, correctness issues, on the edge cases of what like volatile means in Java on different hardware platforms, because the different hardware platforms can have kind of different guarantees and you need to do different things. And so really you almost have to go into lawyer mode and really define all your terms and write everything down and write up all the scenarios of every possible interaction and what should this mean. And a lot of times, like, these scenarios, it's like, both seem good. And, or maybe for the, you know, maybe there might be four things that are going to happen. And it's not immediately evident which is the quote-unquote correct one to choose. And so this actually, in between 1995 and 2005, was really almost a kind of a growing up period for our software industry. I actually became aware of the Java memory model rewrite in, I think it was around 2008 after it happened, or I'm not sure, but I was reading David Dice's blog, and I'll link to that. He was at Sun at the time. I think he's currently at Oracle. I mean, his current blog seems to be hosted at Oracle, although all the Sun ones got moved over, but I assume he's an Oracle employee. And so it's really important to, we basically went through a period of experimentation in the industry where we had like chipsets like the Alpha that was what's known as weakly consistent, and that and Alpha is very fast and was designed to throw away as much baggage as possible. And it turns out that in a multiprocessor Alpha is us the lack of guarantees was just too much. It's like the first version of Alpha the guarantees were really just not enough for how software is written today. And so over the course of, 3 years, the GSR 311 community, or I forget what the 131, something like that. But this was basically the, what happened? What with the committee that met and tried to figure all this stuff out that ended up creating the Java memory model of 2005. They worked through all these scenarios. They're like, okay, this is a scenario. This is the four ways it could go, and we know that the Alpha is too weak. Like, and we actually have problems programming that and making sense of it. And so they started ratcheting up the requirements of what the hardware needs to guarantee. And so there's this basically this contract, this little dance you have to do, this kind of like this set of guarantees on both sides of the fence. And it comes down to start with Java. Java will guarantee sequential consistency if you write data race free programs. And so this is known as SCDRF. And so data race free. So race condition is when timing inadvertently affects program behavior. So if as in a concurrent program. So if you write a program that timing is inadvertently affecting your program's output or behavior, you're in undefined land. No one can help you anyway. It's undefined land. So you have to write data race-free programs, which is also really hard, it turns out. But as Herb Suttler said in his presentation, it's merely hard. It's not like basically the impossibility of trying to work with the Alpha.
Well, that's good.
So that was only the first generation Alpha. They learned that lesson in subsequent models got better. So sequential consistency. So this is the idea that, you know, that the processor still has, you know, all this idea that it can rewrite your programs, and the compilers can do it, and the caches can, you know, copy data out from underneath you and move things around, whatever fastest. But if you just don't write programs that have races in them, they will make, their guarantee to you is that everything will appear to be sequentially consistent. And so this turns out to be really the practical minimum that's required for today's software. And so Java took, you know, really kind of, there were a lot of thoughts behind this. We actually, like, you know, had to create like new terms in terms of in our industry just to like name this stuff. And this is this really fantastic work. And it ended up being picked up by the C and C++. And circa C11 and C++11 in 2011, it is now the memory model. So for the, I think it's for the first time, C and C++ has this memory model that they, if you write race-free programs, they will guarantee sequential consistency. And so this is one that really points out like how young our industry is, that, you know, I mean, it's freaking 2011 in for C to like basically guarantee correct programs, right? It's not even, I don't even know if they're guaranteed that, because you obviously can, but I mean, this is really basic stuff in terms of software correctness in a multiprocessor environment. And we're so recently just figuring this stuff out and creating terms for it. And one of the interesting things here is that I don't know how this affects Objective-C. I Google around for Objective-C memory model, and unfortunately, it's all about ARC, and it's all about, like, IVAR layouts and all this.
Right.
And so it's like a bunch of Google notes. I don't know how to nail it down. I assume, because of Clang and its history, that effectively the C11 memory model is probably kind of inherited by Objective-C, especially if you view Objective-C as a strict superset of C. I don't know. So that's a question for our listeners. So let's go through kind of a few of the processors, and we could talk about kind of their trade-offs. So the Intel x86 is actually surprisingly strongly consistent. And I think that it kind of has to do with its like legacy code base, but it's actually takes a bit of a performance penalty because of it, although x86 is obviously pretty darn fast, so it doesn't suffer greatly. And so in terms of like the type of fence instructions or barrier instructions you have to put in there, it's not so bad. Although you end up paying for it for every load. So the idea here is that there are essentially two classes of barriers. There's kind of the stop the world, I want to get off barrier, where you're saying, okay, things are happening that are important to execute in exactly the order I specified, so processor, do it. And the processor doesn't, everything in flight has to, like, okay, it slows down, it talks, all the processors talk among themselves, and they're like, okay, now we'll go in lockstep for this little bit of time. Or, like, not necessarily lockstep, but, you know, you get the idea that there's a big speed bump there. The more specific way you can go about doing it is where you can say, this specific load and this specific store has to proceed in order. And that's obviously a lot more fine-grained, and that tends to happen more at the cache line level. And like different processors like the ARM actually have not so much a cache line, but it's actually something you can define at runtime, like how big your granularity is there in terms of a validation of a nearby store, what that affect you. But so the idea there is that it doesn't have to stop the world, that it knows that this cache line is special, and you only have to talk amongst your other cores about that cache line. So that's so your performance isn't as negatively affected. So the PowerPC is weakly consistent, and interesting thing is that I told you, like, this is actually really recent that the software industry has actually figured out what is the practical minimum that's required. And obviously x86 predates it, so it's strongly consistent. It's too strongly consistent. There's some performance optimizations it could make that it doesn't. PowerPC is actually too weakly consistent. And what ends up happening is that I mentioned before the sledgehammer instruction of sync and isync and stuff like that, that it because it's so weak, you have to overreach. and use these very heavy, big instructions when you could use something that's less powerful in terms of specifying what the barriers are for how these things need to proceed in order. And what's interesting is that ARM V8, and this is, for now, we're winding back to the original correction from Daniel Steffen, that in ARM V8, they added instructions. Before, ARM was also too weakly consistent, like the PowerPC. But now they've added, ARM V8 has added two instructions, LDRA and STRL. So LDRA is load and acquire. And STRL is for store link. And I believe that's store link. Anyway, this is the granularity I was talking about, is that instead of just doing a run-of-the-mill load, you can do a special load that says, I'm loading this, and this is one of the things that needs to be in the order I specify. And that tells the processor you can't reorder things and helps with and informs a cache system that's where that in the MESI thing comes in, that shared bit, that on tag on the cache line, that's when the bit gets set, where it's like, oh, you're actually going to read this line out of the cache. So that means all the caches need to get on board. That bit needs to be propagated to the other caches to know that things are happening here, that this needs to proceed in order. And then when you store the, and you store the, you do the release, and that's also the effect of communication, where that the process broadcasts among themselves saying, okay, this has happened. And so I think, okay, 41 minutes in, and yeah. So there's a few great articles on this stuff. I had to kind of piece together this coherent narrative from a few major sources. The first one was Paul McKinney wrote both a paper and a pair of Linux Journal articles that kind of approaches from the software side. And in particular, the paper is really good, but pretty detailed. So I'd recommend maybe starting with the Linux Journal articles, and I'll link to those. And Brian Gotez, who I previously, who is the guy I quoted, he wrote on IBM's DeveloperWorks website, whose URLs amazingly continue to work year in and year out, Java Theory and Practice, Fixing the Java Memory Model, wrote parts 1 and 2. There seems to be a theme here where, like, no one can talk about this stuff thus in one part, so there always needs to be 1 or 2 parts.
Except us.
Yeah, that's how awesome we are. And, of course, we're the chickens ourselves. Now I'll have to do a follow-up episode where I mournfully say that everything I've told you is incorrect. So that's where he talks about the Java memory model and kind of the background or what exactly was wrong with it that they needed to address. And finally, oddly enough, the Linux kernel itself inside the source code tree inside documentation/memory-barriers.txt is a surprisingly readable introduction to all this stuff. And even though all they got is ASCII to work with, they do little diagrams, and it's really tractable and kind of, and I mean, it does get into like the nitty-gritty of what the functions are you should call and when. But just from a, even if you don't care about Linux programming, the first few, like I would say 3 or 4 sections is a really actually a surprisingly good introductory, very surprisingly detailed, but a good introductory introduction to this topic. And that does it for me.
Okay. So I had one question that hopefully we can handle here. What does raceless code mean in this context?
It would be like whenever you... So if you have like a local variable and that isn't shared, that pretty much by definition can't be racy, right? Because no one else can touch it on another thread. However, if you were to make decisions, or it doesn't even need to be actually even making decisions, but if that variable is shared across multiple threads,
right?
Then all of a sudden you have, you know, this is right now you should be like, you know, this is a standard warning bell that should go off whenever you get near threads, is that when you have a shared variable, you know you should wrap those in critical sections or have some sort of semaphore or mutex to deal with this stuff. Because unprotected, you basically never know what state is in at any time. And if you make decisions off that, how your software is going to run is undefined.
That just seems fairly high level for something that's, you know, we're talking about sort of processor level and cache level.
Well, that's one of the nice things about the sequential consistency for data erase free programs is that you have all this amazing amount of like architectural stuff underneath, and that's the only thing that they ask of you, and that's pretty, you know, it's easy to actually get into that problem, but they're asking very little of the software guys, which is probably fitting.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it would seem like this would be a fairly, like, I could just decide in my code to access a variable from two different threads. Like, there's no way that the compiler could prevent me from doing that, could it?
Well, it depends on, you see, a lot of this is that I've been talking specifically about, like, C and C++, where they have the entire thing where, and potentially, part of your program could be actually generated by another compiler, another C compiler that they don't control, and you have like link time boundaries where I can't make guarantees of what your code is doing, and so there's like some weird political stuff there in terms of just how it's not like, you know, IBM versus Apple or something like that. It's more like how they think software systems should be defined, and so it turns out like you can do things where. Herb Sutter in his presentation points out that if you write your own function that can like lock some mutex, like how does the compiler know that that will do the ordering that you need? And actually, because it can actually go look at the code, and so it can see you're using these atomic intrinsics or whatever that you need to use. However, if it doesn't, if it's in a .o file somewhere that the compiler doesn't know about, it has to be conservative. And it can't take a bunch of optimizations that normally it could. So to answer your question, the more the compiler knows, the more it could potentially optimize and warn you for unsafe stuff. But because of how software is built today, it's uncommon, and it's a continuing hard problem. And it's not just the software architecture of how things are built, not just the build tools. It's also at runtime of how these pieces work together is also undefined, because obviously, you know, I could be using a different version of Kling than you're using.
Yes. Well, you are only paid minimum wage. and so I guess this is one argument for trying to work in as high level a programming language as you can, because the more the programming language can optimize things out underneath you, and you only specify things in a high-level way instead of in the very detailed way you can, especially in C, the better chance you have for these sorts of optimizations to be applied by the system.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. All righty. So I guess that's it, and we'll see you next time.